Hello, I'm Maya Bloomberg. Thank you for joining us for the Health Equity in the Context of New and Emerging Therapies for Hemophilia. This initiative is supported by an education grant from Novo Nordisk Incorporated. This is the second of two CMEO snacks in the series. Today, we will be taking a deeper dive into racial and ethnic disparities in the context of new and emerging treatments in hemophilia. Again, I'm Maya Bloomberg. I'm a hematology nurse practitioner specializing in congenital bleeding disorders and sickle cell. And for the last 10 years, I've been the adult nurse coordinator at the University of Miami Hemophilia Treatment Center. I'm very pleased to be joined today by Dr. Tammy Crissentieri-Singleton, who I will ask to introduce herself. Welcome, Dr. Singleton.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to be here. I think that talking about this incredibly important subject matter is an honor. So again, I'm Tammy Singleton. I'm a pediatric hematologist by training, but for many years I've had the pleasure and the opportunity to treat both children and adults living with rare bleeding and clotting disorders in the community. I'm currently the Chief Science Officer at the American Thrombosis and Hemostasis Network, AFHN. I also continue to see patients within our community at the Ochsner Clinic Foundation in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Awesome. Very happy to have you here.
Absolutely.
Here is our learning objective for today's program. After participating in this activity, learners should be able to implement strategies to help achieve racial and ethnic equity in the care of patients with hemophilia. Now, to set the stage for our discussion, I'd like to briefly review just how far we've come in terms of therapies. Factor replacement therapy has been the standard of care approach to managing hemophilia for decades. However, we didn't have our first factor concentrate until 1968. Prior to this, life expectancy for hemophilia was pretty grim since they really relied on blood transfusions. Then in the 1950s and 60s, we had fresh frozen plasma transfusions. However, these contained insufficient amounts of factor to really effectively control the severe bleeding. In 1965, cryoprecipitate was discovered and contained that concentrated clotting pathways, which paved the way for more effective treatment options. And we know the 80s is kind of what began that blood era. However, what came of this was the viral inactivation, which ensured safety of the blood products, and also the creation of our first recombinant factor products in the 90s. We then had our extended half-life, with the first one being introduced in 2014, which offered higher troughs with somewhat less frequent infusions. We then had emicizumab, which is a factor VIII mimetic, which was first approved in 2017 for our inhibitor patients and then had an expanded approval for non-inhibitors and was the first subcutaneous prophylaxis treatment for hemophilia A. And there are several other rebalancing agents in the pipeline that seek to increase that thrombin production for bleed protection. Lastly, we have gene therapy, where a single infusion offers the potential of converting somebody from severe hemophilia to mild and ideally get them off of prophylaxis. Now, our challenge really is to ensure that all patients, regardless of race and ethnicity and socioeconomic status, will be able to benefit from these advances. So, Dr. Singleton, let's talk about some of the disparities in hemophilia care and ways that we can address them.
Absolutely. So, in looking at that timeline, we've had incredible progress within the hemophilia community in terms of treatment. It's incredibly fascinating, especially over the past 10 years, to be a witness to all of that advancement and to understand the impact that it's really had on this community. But to your point, Maya, there's still some significant issues. And we're here today to talk a little bit about what some of those issues are. And disparities in terms of what happens between different groups of patients is incredibly important for us to highlight. So let's take a look in terms of some of those disparities in hemophilia care when we're talking about non-Hispanic Black patients, minority patients versus some of our white patients within the community. So take a look at this. So non-Hispanic Black patients are less likely to receive prophylaxis. Less likely to receive home therapy than white patients. And I saw some of this firsthand in hemophilia care, almost sort of scratching my head, trying to figure out, well, why do we have this disparity? We also see a significant issue in terms of inhibitors. So Black and Hispanic patients have a twofold, at least twofold higher frequency of inhibitor development in comparison to white patients. And again, that's despite having similar genetic mutations. We also know from previous studies that there are similar levels in terms of adherence to treatment across patient groups. However, many times Black patients will still have a report of a higher incidence of chronic pain and a lower quality of life. So really, really interesting, right? That disparity. Now, let's take a look at what happens globally in terms of functional status. I bet you could kind of have an appreciation for this. And that's that Black patients typically have a worse functional status than white patients. And again, that's across all age groups. And that is independent of inhibitor status. Now, something else that has been studied across the groups in terms of white patients and Black patients, and that's just in general, Black patients have worse outcomes than white patients. So what I just highlighted are significant disparities, and these disparities are not due to just biology. This is something from a systemic standpoint that's really important for us to take a look at.
I totally agree. It's upsetting when we read some of these statistics, especially when it comes to chronic pain and quality of life. And it really just emphasizes the importance as providers, how we really need to evaluate and take a holistic approach when we're evaluating our patients. Because if we just focus on managing the hemophilia alone, we're kind of missing the mark and we're not necessarily ensuring the best health outcomes. Well, I think it's a perfect time to kind of dive into social determinants of health because recognizing and addressing the social determinants of health really will have that positive impact because they are what ultimately influence the health outcomes and contribute to health disparities. And our social determinants of health can include social and economic factors. There was a study that actually found 40% of an individual's social and economic factors influence health outcomes. So this is your income and housing stability and access to transportation, which can all impact an individual's ability to adhere to a treatment regimen or a prophylaxis regimen, let alone make it to an appointment. So when we're thinking about why is there even a disparity in prophylaxis, if we're prescribing, like I know I treat my patients the same. If I have somebody with severe hemophilia, I am definitely going to recommend prophylaxis regardless of the color of their skin. But why are we seeing these statistics? And we kind of have to dive deeper and see what are the factors. So is it a matter of not being able to afford it? Is there a financial burden? And we have to know what questions to ask to identify what these barriers of access to care and access to treatment are. Because you and I both know there's a lot of patient assistance and financial assistance, whether from the drug manufacturers or patient assistance programs and the copay assistance programs or third-party foundations. Like there's always a way to get a product, almost always, I should say, get a product for a patient, whether they're uninsured or underinsured. But we have to know that individuals are having problems and with accessing. So again, asking the right questions to identify what the barriers are is so important as a provider to make sure that our patients are receiving ultimately what they need. And I think there's also just a general mistrust among minority groups, among healthcare providers. And I totally empathize and understand where it comes from because we just have countless instances of medical exploitation. I mean, as early as the Tuskegee Airmen and Henrietta, that there's just all of these generational traumas that impact a complete community and effects of trust among your provider. And that can ultimately impact treatment decisions and adherence as well.
Yeah, I think that you kind of really hit the nail on the head when you highlighted asking the right questions, right? It's asking the why. Like, why is this actually happening? I mean, when you have the provider patient relationship, a patient is not going to come in and say, you know, I don't really trust you. But I think we have to have some sensitivity and understanding that that is an issue. And to your point, it is an issue for because of a lot of things that have happened in the past, generational things that have passed forward, just sort of maybe a natural imbalance because of the relationships between racial groups, even within our society, just recognizing that when you have something so intimate, if you will, and when you're in a position where you're incredibly vulnerable, when you're seeking care, that it's important to recognize that maybe we don't have the automatic trust that we would like to have between patients and provider, and maybe having a focus on that. Highlighting one more thing too, Maya, I think that's really important is asking the why and really trying to find out and identify specific issues. People are not necessarily monolithic and within a racial group or society. So we want to find out as individuals, well, what's the real issue? So is the real issue that with your position or your job, you don't have time to come in all the time. So it's difficult to establish that relationship, right? So there are a lot of things that can contribute.
And as a provider too, implicit bias is something that can definitely impact subconsciously our how we carry out care and the type of conversations that we have. And as a reminder, implicit bias is that automatic type of reaction we have towards other people, and these attitudes and stereotypes can negatively impact our understanding, actions, and decision making. So it just highlights as providers, we really need to self-reflect because, as you said, these disparities are not due to biology. It's due to the systemic racism that our country was founded on. And we just need to reflect on ourselves and see how these biases can potentially impact how we're having conversations and making decisions, et cetera. And I think when we're having conversations with patients, there's like this new wave of trauma-informed care because we all have different traumas, just vicarious traumas, just seeing what's on the news or hearing stories of other people. There's so many things that impact how a person functions that the new wave of trauma-informed care, I think, is so important when we're trying to just make sure our patients are getting what they need.
Absolutely. And it completely highlights some of the things that we've already discussed, like where it sort of makes sense, like with some of the disparities, some of the issues with inhibitor development and how that's higher in Black and Hispanic communities. And that, of course, leads to issues with cost and insurance coverage. If you're less likely to receive home therapy or home care, that kind of relates back to assistance with learning how to infuse and perhaps participating with prophylaxis. And many times, this is a really big one, that whole language discordance. Even if you're speaking the same language, sometimes in terms of communication and understanding, if from a cultural standpoint, you need someone to be really direct or you're accustomed to someone being really direct in order to really understand and appreciate something, and there's a gap with that, that could be a pretty significant issue. So I think it really highlights how all of these things with all of these things being contributors, right, to racial and ethnic disparities within our hemophilia care, they're connected.
And then, when we're talking about just with the evolving hemophilia landscape and all the advent of these new novel therapies in the pipeline, it creates another level of complexity when it comes to treating our patients. And this is where shared decision making really plays a part because we don't have any evidence-based best treatment option. So it leaves patient preference really weighing in, and not just patient preference. Again, we have to think of their entire support system, where they live, what they have access to. Because, say, you have somebody who lives really far away from a hemophilia treatment center and they don't know how to self-infuse, then maybe doing a novel therapy, which is a subcutaneous injection, might be more appropriate. But then we also have to think about health literacy because there's a lot more education that comes in with these rebalancing agents since they're only for prophylaxis. So there's so many nuances that go into making a decision. And I think with all of the advancements and the growing number of treatment options, it's definitely complexifying the situation. And from a racial and ethnic disparity standpoint, we want to make sure that we're really addressing all aspects of care to make sure that it's not going to further contribute to worse health outcomes for minorities.
Absolutely. And I think that there was one thing really that you said in terms of health disparities and making that connection there with shared decision making that I think is incredibly important, right? And that's about education and meeting the patients where they are to make sure that we can make that connection. If we don't have that aspect within that shared decision making in terms of meeting the patients where they are, then I think we're going to have other issues down the line, and especially issues with patients participating in clinical trials.
Well, that's a perfect segue. So let's talk about clinical trial participation in persons with hemophilia from communities of color. What are we seeing from a disparity standpoint?
Yeah, this is incredibly interesting, and it makes sense. So, you mentioned a little earlier, Maya, some of the trauma that especially patients within minority communities, Black communities especially, have faced over the course of time when interfacing with clinical trials and development of clinical trials within the community. One of them, I can tell you from a family perspective that has been passed along, is remembering what happened with the Tuskegee experiment. And so there's a lack of trust when you say research or you say clinical trial, that something is going to be imposed on you, that something unfair or something unsafe may happen. So I think that because all of those feelings that are justified, fears that are justified because of what happened before, because all of those things exist, we still see a pretty significant proportion of patients that participate in hemophilia care that are Black patients, especially. They are not participating in clinical trials. Again, so that there's this disparity that you're seeing demonstrated here. So, despite our efforts in terms of trying to provide education and offering across the board clinical trials to participants, we still have a significant issue in terms of Black and Hispanic people participating in clinical trials. Black patients, participants, Hispanic patients, and possible participants are consistently underrepresented in hemophilia clinical trials. And as you can see here, this is some data from 2007 to 2022, taking a look at white patients with the bar graph, the bar or the line represented in red, Asian patients represented in the line that's yellow. And you can see there Black patients coming in almost dead last in terms of participating in clinical trials. So we certainly know that we need to have strategies to overcome the underrepresentation of historically marginalized populations. And I think, again, going back to your statement with shared decision making, I think it starts with that connection. I think it starts with education and meeting the patients where they are. When speaking to Black and Hispanic patients, I think it would be incredibly important when presenting them with the opportunity to participate in a clinical trial to explain some of the safety measures that are in place for human protections within clinical research because of some of the atrocities that have happened in the past. I also think it's important that we recognize that we may have our own bias, which you've mentioned before too, in terms of approaching patients, thinking that they are not good candidates, perhaps, or may not be interested in a clinical trial, and making sure that we provide an opportunity for them to participate.
You've said so much, but I think again, this kind of ties in the importance of utilizing trauma-informed care so we can validate one's hesitancy potentially to participate in clinical trials. And I think it's also really important for us to review why is it even important for minority representation in clinical trials, because ultimately all of the data that is gathered in clinical trials is then generalized for all patients with hemophilia. Like I remember, I forget which medication, but there was a breast cancer drug that in the clinical trials, it was predominantly white individuals who were in the study and they generalized all of the results. But fast forward, once it's actually FDA approved, they found out that it wasn't as responsive for people of color. Yet, had they had more minority representation in that clinical trial, maybe they would have realize that result and disparity earlier on and could have impacted health outcomes. You mentioned how we now have a lot of stuff in place because of those instances of medical exploitation. We have the IRB, which really reads through the entire study design with a fine-tooth comb to ensure safety. And when I talk to patients about what the process is to enroll in a clinical trial, the first thing I emphasize is that it's completely voluntary from start to finish. Like if you stub your toe and you decide you want to leave, You can discontinue at any time. And then I also, before they ever get the informed consent, I always warn them, this is a very lengthy document. There's going to be a section talking about the risks, and it might be very intimidating when you read it. But the point is we want to be extremely transparent with everything. And most of the time we do know what the risks are. And because of that, it's kind of weaved into the study design, different labs and diagnostics. So we have a better chance of identifying it early before it ever got to a point of negatively impacting your health. So we all know minority representation is so important when it comes to clinical trials, but I think utilizing some of those strategies and just having more meaningful conversations and getting curious for what the hesitation is just different strategies we can do to try to encourage more involvement.
I think it's incredibly important when we think about minority populations, Black patients, Hispanic patients, and clinical trials. As you were mentioning, to highlight the safety measures that are in place. But I also think it's incredibly important to go back and think about some of those disparities and reasons for those disparities that we mentioned before, in making sure that patients from minority groups actually have an opportunity to participate, considering some of the challenges that may be associated with coming back for the follow-up visit, or having like more detailed discussions. If we have to have phone contact so that you can participate in this study, we can sort of arrange times that may work for you because of work schedules, family schedules. So I think just being a little more deliberate in meeting patients where they are, to make sure that we have equal representation, will be really important.
Definitely. And this all boils down to, again, evaluating the social determinants of health, where if you are part of a hemophilia treatment center, a lot of times the social worker will do psychosocial evaluations, which kind of overview financial security, housing stability, income, et cetera. So again, we can identify any barrier that could prevent somebody from either successfully participating in a clinical trial or just having access to their treatments and care. Now, I
Absolutely.
think at this point, we should review some definitions because our ultimate goal is health equity, and that is the attainment of the highest level of health for all people. And achieving health equity, again, requires valuing everybody equally with focused and ongoing societal efforts to address those preventable inequalities, historical and contemporary injustices, and the elimination of health and healthcare disparities. So again, as a reminder, health disparities are the preventable differences in health due to social, economic, and/or environmental factors and not biology. Now, I just want to spend a little time for you to differentiate race from racism, because again, I want everyone to understand that it's racism, not race, as that major driver of differential health outcomes in the United States. So, Dr. Singleton, do you want to differentiate the two for us?
Absolutely. So race is really just a social construct, and it is tied directly to one's appearance. So when we say appearance and this social classification, we refer to that as a phenotype. And this phenotype, of course, governs the distribution of risks and opportunities. I want to just share something really quickly. When I was young and we talked about race in my family, as you can see with these sort of beautiful children standing here, I couldn't understand race as this social construct. You know, I went, okay, well, you're peach and you're brown and you're light brown and you're a lighter shade of peach. And it's difficult to really understand, but eventually, we all have an appreciation for this social construct in terms of race, and it really represents one's physical appearance and/or phenotype. Now, that is different. So race is that social construct based on your phenotype, how you appear. Racism, right, is more of a system. Racism is when we have a social structuring in terms of opportunities, assigning value based on how a person appears, the social interpretation of looks or how someone appears, advantages or unfairly disadvantages for individuals and communities, again, based on appearance. So it's more of a system and not just the assignment that we have from a societal standpoint of how someone appears. It's the unfair advantages and indiv from with individuals and communities that are associated with that. So our whole society is based on, or can be based on, this system of structuring. So racism, not race, is the major driver of differential health outcomes in the US. And I just want to say that one more time, right? So it's the racism, not race, that's the majority driver, again, of these differences in terms of health outcomes that we're talking about today.
That was perfect definition. And when you're speaking, I just reflect on myself where I'm almost embarrassed to say that I didn't really understand white privilege or the differences until the whole George Floyd incident that happened. And I think once you have the awareness is when you can start bringing the change and just again, self-reflecting and just on a societal level, have more advocacy and effort. So I think this conversation we're having is so important because awareness is the first step to bring any type of change and more importantly, bring a more equitable future to our minority population, really to everyone. Do you want to just touch on maybe the difference between cultural humility versus cultural competence? Because it kind of all ties together when it comes to
Yeah.
health equity and the way we carry out care for
Absolutely.
patients.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's your statement was actually perfect for this, because what you were describing, Maya, you described cultural humility, right? So we are, I think, are pretty familiar with the concept of cultural competence. So your level of awareness, education, experience regarding various cultures. But cultural humility is incredibly important, because really it's the difference between, I know who you are already, I know your experience, I understand what's happening to you, versus I'm really curious to know about who you are and what your experience is, because I don't have, right, that experience. So that's what you just described. And I think it's really important as professionals, as providers, as physicians, nurses, medical professionals, educators, social workers, that we recognize that concept of cultural competence, that we don't have all knowledge, right, that's needed to really connect with different groups, and we don't want to generalize. So that cultural humility, and again, you provided a perfect example, is incredibly important to recognize what you don't know, and to have that curiosity, and to extend that deference to a group of people or an individual, so that you can really connect with those people. And I think this is a place with those people or persons. And I think it's incredibly important to have this concept in place, so that we can overcome a lot of the barriers that we mentioned before.
So we've talked about social determinants of health. We've talked about racism and cultural humility and competence and just recognizing what we know, what we don't know in efforts to bring health equity. So I think this graphic really summarizes what we want to achieve for all of our patients with regards to hemophilia. And that is that functional cure that really will allow somebody to live their life without having to overthink about their condition. And this path kind of shows what the clinical outcomes that can be achieved with better bleed protection. And with the treatment options in the pipeline, I wouldn't be too surprised if we start seeing mild and moderates being started on prophylaxis as the method of delivery and frequency becomes more and more convenient. And I think also I have to give credit to a lot of the pharma companies because I think they're doing a lot in order to get the patient perspective and making sure that different gaps and barriers are being identified and seeing where can they step in order to help bring that ultimate goal of health equity. Because it's going to take a village. It's not just a patient provider type of dynamic. It's really going to take so many different hands on deck to achieve the unimaginable and bring that health equity where you have that unrestricted lifestyle with hemophilia. So I think we kind of keep involving patients and making sure that their voices are heard and respected and valued. I think providers need to continue to self-reflect and just understand if You're just trying to treat the hemophilia by itself. You're missing the mark. We really need to evaluate the patient as a whole and just understand what can be contributing beyond just having hemophilia towards them achieving their optimal health outcomes.
Absolutely. I love your concept. That's a favorite one of mine as well, that it takes a village. And I think that our village is so incredibly strong in the within hemophilia care, and that is centered with the community and centered right with patients. And to have an honor as a provider to participate in that, to have the support of research, to have the support of industry, I think is so incredibly important that we pull together as a village to walk these stairs to get to optimize health and well-being.
I agree. Unfortunately, this is about all the time we have today. So I'd love to thank you, Dr. Singleton. It's honestly always a pleasure getting to connect and talk with you and just hear your advice and expertise. And thanks to our audience for participating as well. Before we close, though, I'd like to offer a few SMART goals, which are specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely action items you can apply to the care of patients in your own practice. With the first one being the importance of just staying current with the new and emerging therapies for hemophilia. You want to recognize the significant disparities that persist in hemophilia care and take steps to overcome them. Assess and address social determinants of health. And lastly, engage patients and families in shared decision making while also considering the social determinants of health. And thank you, everybody, for listening in.